Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Ready for Your Pre-the Liberties Current Affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Your Pre-the Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. You remember Putin's palace, right? We just found out that there is also Mirziyoyev's dacha, the secret resort of Uzbekistan's president uncovered by our Uzbek service, locally known as Ozodlik. Contractors reportedly toiled day and night to finish it in time for 2018 visit by none other than the Russian president himself. There's a guarded perimeters around it and no-fly zone above it. And the buildings are reportedly filled with luxurious Italian furniture. It's a development estimated by some to have cost several hundred million dollars. But that's not all. There have been other hidden costs, like an ancient river dried up after a reservoir was built next to the resort and people were left without water supply. A family working to protect nature in the idyllic area was driven away. Their home was also razed. From whatever direction you look at this, the entire project looks nothing like the image of the man who, 1 month after sworn in as the president, promised human rights protections, greater transparency, and anti-corruption efforts. In this context, the revelations couldn't be more striking. So on today's Majlis podcast, we decided to focus on the findings of the investigation and how it relates to what else might be happening in Uzbekistan in recent years. And more importantly, what all that might mean for Mirziyoyev. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Carl Schreck, Ready for Pre-the Liberties Enterprise Editor, Dilmira Matyakubova, a researcher, co-director at UZ Investigations. It's an NGO working on exposing corruption in Uzbekistan. Mira is joining us from Tashkent. Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Pre-the Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today on a very short notice. So, Carl, let's start with you. Thank you very much for this great work. Though the credit goes to our Uzbek service, you have been closely working with them to get this report out to the wider audience. So what has been some of the major findings from your perspective, Carl, in this investigation?
You know, it's a big project that we put together. I guess for me, the most interesting thing was the fact that they built basically a reservoir from scratch here. I mean, there's so many really been fascinating and strange things about this whole project. I mean, the absolute secrecy surrounding it. I mean, this was presented great challenges from an open source perspective, because there, as we noted in the report, there are no on the ground photos of this compound anywhere. And sources told our reporters that construction workers were first forced to hand over their mobile phones before entering the premises. So really, our only view of this was from satellite, but satellite imagery turned out to be very helpful in showing, particularly historical satellite imagery, in showing the development of this compound. You know, we would look at imagery starting from 2010, and you can see, you know, there's the Chavasai River, you know, running through this area. We see a little hunting lodge pop up around 2014 or so. Our sources told us that this was a hunting lodge for Achabaya Ramatov. And then you see over the next few years how the compound just grows and grows, and the homes that are along this river gorge are raised. You can see it on the satellite, and then the whole area is filled up by a reservoir. I want to say it's about 3 kilometers long, and you see this compound emerge with helicopter pads and huge landscape gardens. And so, you know, again, the fact that this was all kept so hush-hush, and then our reporters also, we dug in, and we were searching through aerospace regulations and discovered that it was covered by one of 6 no-fly zones in the area. So, and 4 other residences of Mirziyoyev are covered by no-fly zones. So, you know, it's interesting, and then you can see everything happening by satellite, and yet everything on the ground was kept completely in secret.
You are also saying, Carl, in the report that this to be a luxurious resort. What does that mean? What we should understand from that?
Well, as you can see from satellite, it's a big sprawling compound with big structures. But of course, from satellite, you can you really only see the the roofs. You know, you can get an idea of the scale of the building, but we don't have any view inside of it. But what people, you know, several sources who had been on the grounds told us is there was basically a mansion built for Mirziyoyev's use, and there are several other buildings for guests and a hunting lodge. but that the mansion that sources said was for Mirziyoyev's use was very expensively furnished with imports from Italy. You know, we tried our best to corroborate this, to get, you know, photographs or find something. That was turned out impossible to get. We did manage to track down some open source customs records showing that in 2018, the year that the compound was mostly finished, there was a huge spike in imports of Italian furniture to Uzbekistan. You know, upwards, I want to say off the top of my head, went from something like $18 million in 2017 to like $51 million in 2018. Now, we don't know exactly that data does not show who sent the furniture or who received it, but it was just an interesting timing. It would be interesting if we could get the bill of lading on those shipments and to see what companies shipped them and who received them in Uzbekistan.
Yeah, just one more thought on that. I mean, we also talk about in the investigation that this property's impact on the biosphere. How so, Carl?
Well, you know, another interesting thing about this is that this compound is located on the southern tip of what is now a, you know, protected land, a state biosphere reserve, which was formally created in May 2018 when construction was already underway. From satellite, we see that the reservoir was being filled as early as April 2018. And the following month, they created this biosphere reserve that includes a section of the UNESCO-protected Western Tian Shan. And so it's located on a bioreserve, and they built a brand new reservoir here. It was already underway when it became part of this biosphere reserve. But of course, you know, a water resources expert we talked to said, of course, you know, building reservoirs would have a very major impact on the local ecology. And secondly, we were unable to get any official answers as to what formal purpose this reservoir serves, whether it's hydroelectricity, whether it's for irrigation. The only information we were able to get from our sources was that it was for recreation, for specifically for the services of this compound. We still have not received any formal explanation after our report. Uzbekistan Railways is claiming that this is basically a small resort for their employees. Yeah. And they note in the statement that a small reservoir was built. So that's the closest we've ever gotten to any formal explanation as to what, if any, purpose this reservoir on the state biosphere reserve.
Yeah. No, we are going to talk about the response by the Uzbek Railway. That's very interesting. And also, when Carl, you were talking about, I mean, the resort, no-fly zone, and guarded perimeters, the story sounds very, very familiar to people in Turkmenistan. You know, I know it as someone who was the director of the Turkmen service before I came to Washington, D.C. So during the previous president there in Turkmenistan, he removed everyone from a similar area in the outskirts of Ashgabat, built his own resort in. That was the last day when people had access to one of the few resorts the country has. You know, in some ways, Central Asian leaders are very, very predictable. Also, colleagues, Bruce and Mira, please help me to read Carl's brain here on this report. Please jump in when you would like to say anything, you would like to add something, or you have a question to Carl. So let's make the best use of his presence today on the show. Also, the amount that earlier you were talking about, Carl, we are saying, like in the report, the actual cost could be estimated around a couple of $100 million. Given the secrecy that you are describing, how do we know this?
Yes, so this is another very difficult angle on this story is that it was built formally under the leadership of Uzbekistan Railways. And yet, on paper, we have very little financial paperwork, annual reports indicating how much any of this cost. So we relied those estimates, as we point out, those estimates were from people directly aware of or of the project or who had worked on it. I mean, we can see the scale of the project. And when we talked about several hundred million dollars, that estimate would include construction of the dam and the reservoir, extensive road work, which was done to the road leading up to the compound, as well as the landscaping and the buildings themselves, the labor. So the estimates we got included those elements of it as well. So, but, you know, as we asked the questions, you know, how much money did this cost and where did this money come from? No one thought they needed to answer any of these questions prior to publication. So, yes, absolutely. It's just an estimate, as we pointed out. We were not able to independently corroborate this, but given the secrecy around it, it's really all we have to go on.
Right. You know, as per the report, it was built in 2018. Mira, earlier you were telling me that you guys knew something was going on, but it was not clear what was really happening there. I'm just curious to how such mega projects can be really handled with such a secrecy. Yeah, please go ahead.
This is obviously a top-level expose and a case for grand corruption and an amazing job. I want to thank the reporters. And regarding the activists, I think they were traveling to the area, trying to get into the territory where before, well, allegedly they were able to get in, but they were not able when they traveled first, you know, in recent years. And therefore, they started like looking at it and asking questions, why can't we get in? Why can't we get in? So, well, as per the videos as well from the website, and also the activist videos, it's clear that, yeah, no one is allowed unless they have a special permission, right? So it's very interesting, though, the whole case. I mean, it's amazing. I'm still trying to, digest it. A few points here, I think... this is kind of a expected, I think we, at least for me, I expected this. And then I think there is more to it. There might be more residences or palaces are being built that we don't know about. So I think this is a great start, say, and then it's a big opening. What was interesting for me is that, again, yeah, this, the reservoir, why is it? I mean, what is the purpose of it, right? It's enormous, and it caused basically drying of this whole village, right? They are now without water, and they have to travel to other villages to get water. So that's why that was the most kind of a saddening piece of evidence for me to learn about. And also, I mean, I think it's kind of typical of these people like Mirziyoyev, Putin, to build these such things and to show off to each other, right? Because in 2018, Putin came and then he traveled there, so, you know, right? So to show off, this is kind of a, kind of post-Soviet mindset, kind of a friendship, inviting each other and showing, oh, I got this, look. So they also, another point I want to make, is this also showed, kind of tested the limitations of media freedom locally, because we know that the extent of the reporting the local media can make is just limited to that level. I mean, they're not writing about it, they're not reposting, they're not discussing it. Well, social media is discussing, but that's different. I mean, media is not discussing it. The only thing they published is about the reaction from the railway company, right? When we talk about the correlation between the Sardoba Dam, which collapsed, and this thing, right, this complex. I see a correlation there, I mean, a sort of link, because the same companies who participated in the building of the Sardoba Dam participated in the building of this Shovosoy complex. I mean, so the dam collapsed, it cost human lives, and it brought homelessness. People are still living in shelters. We know that not everyone has received replacement for which they lost during the dam collapse. So those are the things that, you know, came to my mind, the link between two buildings, I mean, two constructions on the same companies. They, of course, the magnitude of the project itself is $1 billion. Right. Well, according to my estimates, it's, I think, about $1 billion altogether. If to add up everything, like the reservoir, the road, and the complex itself, I think it is $1 billion.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much, Mira. Bruce, and Mira is kind of pointing at the corruption aspect of this whole thing. You know, what surprised you in this whole investigation, Bruce?
Well, you know, I mean, just it had to be such a secret. And, you know, if you remember when after Karimov died and Mirziyoyev came to power, one of the things they did right away was say he wasn't going to live in Karimov's presidential palace. And they built a whole new one for him, for Mirziyoyev to live in. So he's kind of already on record as having built these kind of projects. So you know, well, I understand Biro was right. I mean, I understand there's a competition between the leaders, you know, and no one wants to go to meet Putin in somewhere in one of his great palaces on the Black Sea or something like that, right? You know, and then when Putin shows up, you just take him, you know, outside the capital to some place or something. So especially a country that, you know, like Uzbekistan, that's got a certain stature in Central Asia, right? So, you know, they want to make sure the place they're taking them to is better than the one in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, and at least as good as the one in Kazakhstan or something, right? But, you know, that's why, you know, the amazing thing was, well, one, it's clearly a waste of money, but two, that they just felt that they knew that it was too much to let the public know what was going on. And I'm not 100% sure that the public, there would have been that much objection if they said, look, we're building this big presidential retreat outside in this one area that's been off limits. As far as ruining the ecosphere, yeah, of course, there would have been some objections to that. But, you know, the whole secrecy that surrounded this just made him look very bad when it, you know, now that it's exposed. It's like, you know, not only did you spend all this money, but you were doing everything you could to try to hide it at the same time. And you didn't even do that well. You know, obviously, they got caught. It was a huge mistake. You know, I mean, it just undercuts any of Mirziyoyev's pledges for the last few years about cracking down corruption and responsibility of government. And, you know, and I mean, let's face it, he ordered last point. He told, you know, the ministers that they should go out and live in the region so that they can find out how the people are living, you know, and then this.
So. Yeah. Oh, no, that you brought us very into a very interesting point. Maybe we should explore that. Thank you very much. So in the meantime, as we earlier, I guess, Carl mentioned, there has been a reaction by the Uzbek authorities since the report went online. So what they were saying and what should we make of that response? And also, as Bruce was hinting, so what does this all might mean for Mirziyoyev, his reputation, his future in his administration, you know, as someone who come to power, bragging about transparency and anti-corruption messages, and you have an election coming up, I guess, later this year. So let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Carl Schrick, Reading for Freedom Liberties Enterprise editor, Delmira Matyakubova, a researcher, co-director at UZ Investigations, the NGO working on exposing corruption. Delmira is joining us from Tashkent. Bruce Panier, the editor of Reading for Freedom Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awasi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast and Reading for Freedom Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the revelations about the Uzbek president's secret resort. Welcome back, colleagues. So the reaction by the Uzbek Railway, Carl, so what they are saying?
Well, basically, what they said, they put out a statement after publication, basically saying that control of that area was handed over to the railways in 2010, and that construction of a resort area there has been carried out gradually over that time, including the construction of a, quote, small reservoir, end quote. And that basically this is one of their company resorts for their employees, for their 90,000 employees. And the statement was issued alongside a short video in which you see a group of people kind of look like tourists being bussed in to the Shavasoy area. I encourage anyone to go look at the video themselves. And it shows them kind of looking around the inside a building there, and it shows the Shavasoy River. And the implication is that this is, you know, a tourist facility. And that's, you know, no big deal. The thing is, it's not visible in the video. You don't see the reservoir. Based on the images that we're seeing, we don't see any of the buildings that we don't see the landscaped gardens. We don't see anything from what satellite shows is the main part of the compound. We do see a sign that says Shavasoy, and we see a river that looks like Shavasoy. So they seem to have been in the area. What's funny is that the next day, Alexei Garshin, the Tashkent-based activist who was the focus of one of our pieces in this package of stories, because as it turned out, he had been poking around as well, trying to figure out what was going on up there. Well, after the Uzbekistan Railway statement, he called up the company, called the switchboard, and was asking, so what is this Shavasoy resort? It's your resort. And the people who answered, the operators of the switchboard, said they had never heard of it. And then Garshin went on to name each of the other company resorts that were named in the statement. And of course, the operator said they had heard of every single one, every single one of the resource company resorts they'd heard of, except for Shavasoy. They said, no, we have no information about that.
Very interesting.
Except the one operator at the beginning, Alexei Talk, said she knew. I mean, she admitted, she answered it about Shavasoy. I mean, she didn't mind that, there was such a thing, such a place as Shavasoy. And when he called next time, the other operator took, and then she had no idea what this is about. And she didn't know about this place, and others also did not know. So it's obviously there's something going on there, as I think. And the reaction, the whole statement by the rival company, I think is ridiculous. It's not realistic, and it doesn't look even truthful. And the whole video doesn't show anything. It just shows a couple of people hanging around on the river or in a canteen somewhere, right? It's just corporate vacation, some sort of. It doesn't really explain, and I don't think the response was adequate or even convincing. I'm not convinced. As for the reputation you mentioned, and also Bruce mentioned that
Dilmira, let's get to that little bit later, but I had a follow-up question about the explanation by the Uzbek authorities, especially the railway response. As an investigator, I can understand the way you are responding to this, but what about the general public, how they are responding to the excuse that the Uzbek railway come up in terms of this project?
Yeah, there are obviously different groups of people. One group says, this whole thing is a hoax, and it's foreign agencies reporting, just like on Navalny, it's a made up story. They're just like refuting it, right? They don't want to listen or hear anything. There is another group who believes that, this is a great revelation and this expose, and it's great. And we know, they kind of expect that there's, they're expecting more, right? So it's really a mixed communities here. You can't really say, just generally speaking, I think a large portion of the population doesn't know about it, because you said
it's not been covered by media, at least the report portion of this.
Covered, as well as there is, blocking of Radio Azad Lake in Uzbekistan. It doesn't open without VPN, and everyone has a VPN, right? In a remote village, for instance, people don't have even internet, so they don't have access to internet or VPN, let alone VPN, but just internet, right? So that's why a bigger portion of the population doesn't know. They don't really know what's happening. Yeah, so that is, there's a reaction, of course, on social media where there's a huge discussion is going on. People are saying, this is a betrayal, this is a disaster. How many more are coming? How many more palaces are coming, right? So there are more aware people who read the news, who read foreign reporting as well. So, but that's the kind of, I think that's the minority group for me, at least from my observations.
That's very interesting. Bruce?
I managed to follow a little bit of the social media discussion as well. And I would say that after we published our investigation, the mix was pretty much as expected. You'd have the people that read the story and recognized the scope of the work and the impact of it, and were generally positive about how our reporters were able to bring this to light. And you had the another side that was, accusing Azad Lake of rocking the boat, or, trying to stir up divisions in society and things like that. That's generally expected for any major investigation. What I did notice about the reaction, at least when I monitored to the Uzbekistan Railways statement, is you didn't have a lot of people jumping in to defend it. There was a lot of mockery that I saw, and some offense taken by some. I remember one comment saying, boy, they really think we're just 10-year-old children.
I guess you have mentioned this in one of your tweets, Carl, or maybe someone else, in response to your tweets, that the response by the railway does not really a response. They are not talking about why there's no fly zone in that area if that is built for as a recreation facility for railway employees, etc. But Bruce, about the, you know, one of the thing that Uzbek authorities mention when they come to Washington, D.C., you know, bragging about it, the change they say has happened in the media landscape in Uzbekistan. But, you know, the stories that Mira and Carl is talking about in terms of the response to this investigation, it doesn't tell much about if there was any huge kind of a change in terms of the press freedom in Uzbekistan, or you read it indifferently.
No, not at all. I mean, come on. It's, you know, those, I'll tell you, because I've seen some of the reports that, the very few that refer to this or to the railway company, right? That's usually what everyone latched onto. One, they don't even name the Azadlik report. I mean, they won't specifically say that's it. You know, what they do is start talking about who the resort was for, you know, and kind of mention that there's been vaguely that there was information that maybe it was something other than what they're trying to, what the railway company claims it is. But, you know, and you can see Uzbek media has changed a little bit. There are some things they report on now that they certainly wouldn't have 10 years ago, you know, and so there's some credit for that. But even when the report came out, I was watching carefully to see if the self-censorship wouldn't go into operation immediately, and that seems to be what happened. I think, you know, even some of the media outlets that have been the most bold, and that's a very relative term, but, you know, Kundaruz and people like that, that have pushed some stories about lower level corruption and things like that. I mean, they stayed away from having to deal with this or going to any depth on it at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and everyone just pretty much the people that did report on it just referred to what the railway company was saying. And like I said, it was interesting that they wouldn't even say where the other information came from at all. They didn't want to mention Azadlik as being part of this. But and if I could just had one comment when you were talking about the railway story. The thing that I think is really funny about that, you know, as Carl's mentioned already, you know, they built a reservoir, they redid the road, you know, all this stuff. They spent all kinds of money for a, you know, a pensionat for the railway workers, a place where they can go on holiday and stuff. And I'm like, well, what? They're railway workers. Why do they need a helicopter pad? Why didn't they build a railway?
Why no fly zone, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, wouldn't that have made a lot of sense if it was a place for railway workers, that instead of spending money to build a road and then anyone can come and stay there, you know, that they would build a railway? And how many railway workers are going to arrive by helicopter? I don't know. So, it's, you know, I thought it was a really poor cover-up story.
It's so interesting. You know, one lie leads to another lie, but it's kind of strange stuff. You know, earlier, Mira, you touched upon this in... let's get into this. I mean, the impact, the possible impact of all this investigation and the silly response that's coming out from the Uzbek Railway, maybe some other authorities will follow up. So in terms of impact, what kind of impact do you expect this to have on Mirziyoyev and his reputation?
Yeah, this is certainly not good news for him, as he cares about the image and reputation so much, and there's a whole legislative basis for building a new image for Uzbekistan, you know, that aims to build a new international reputation for Uzbekistan, and certainly this is not good for that. I think it also depends on how the international community would react and the local community, right? So because, okay, there's an expose, but if there is no reaction, if nobody, you know, talks about it, except us, right? But that might not be considered as something damaging the reputation. It might be just brushed off the carpet and just they carry on, because I'm observing these old apologists, I call the people who brag about the reforms and all that, back Mirziyoyev. They went silent for one day when the report was out, and I've been carefully following. But then again, next day, they were like, oh, good news, like, democratic reforms are giving results and blah, blah, and we're building partnerships with German companies, US, or blah, blah. So it's just continuing, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's instead him. So as if nothing happened and everything is hunky-dory, so Tashkent is not reacting in a serious way. So that's why I think it will depend on how much seriously it will be looked at and you know, considered. I mean, for me, it's a huge thing. I mean, that is different. But again, as I say, how much, for instance, the ambassadors simply saying, or the UN or the ILO, I know that they are not reacting. But I'm just saying that because it is important. But they're just silent. They don't even mention. They tweet only the positive news and all the good news. but no one is interested in bad news. For them, it's bad news, right? It's truth, but they have their own truth. That's how I see it. They don't want to face the reality. They don't want to face dirt of the regime. They just want to do their job and get away with it. I mean, I think that's the most painful part, because I think if there's no reaction, these exposés on certain officials, including the president, will not result in anything, because we had exposés of the mayor and the other officials. And what happened? Well, they're still in their position. They're just continuing. And that is the impunity is the painful part. There is no judge higher than the state. There is no one who can judge, right? Who can say, hey, this is a crime. You're building something for $1 billion and killing people on the other hand, like by constructing a dam that is involved in corruption that, you know, was not built appropriately. But at the same time, you're building a palace for yourself. So there's no one to speak about it, right? To speak the truth to power so that, you know, it is taken seriously and the international community is trying to at least make an attempt to hold these people accountable. And there are a number of, you know, things, recommendations I can make. Well, later on.
Yes, there is a role for international community to play here, but at the end, it's the Uzbek nation who will have to say. And one opportunity that might be coming up soon, Bruce, is the election this year. For some reason, I remember this to be happening over the end of this year, closer to the end of this year, right?
Yes, this year.
Bruce, do you expect there could be any kind of ramification of these revelations to Mirziyoyev? I mean, I do not expect there to be kind of very competitive elections, but again, there is something. I mean, in other countries, for example, it's a huge thing for a candidate who wanting to be a next re-elected or to be a next president.
Well, if it was a free and fair election, it would probably make some difference. It's been a running joke with me and other people that do Central Asia that they probably know the results right now. You know, the election isn't going to be till October, but they probably already figured out what the percentages are going to be and who's going to run against him and everything like that. So, you know, as far as the official figures will show, it probably won't make a lot of difference. You know, I mean, the big thing would be how many monitors they have and if they can see what turnout is. You know, and I don't think anyone in Uzbekistan is under any illusions that Mirziyoyev will lose the election. That's not going to happen. But there might be some people who are turned off by this latest scandal that just wouldn't go and vote. You know, so I think if we could get an honest tally on voter participation, that would be more of an indication of how much damage was done to his reputation. Because, like I said, as far as what the final vote tally is going to show, he's going to win. He's going to win overwhelmingly, you know, not as much as Karimov. Certainly, because that's not, you know, they want to show that there's progress in their country. So he won't win with 98% or something. He'll win with 83% or something like that. But he's still going to win overwhelmingly. And like I said, I don't, as far as the official figures will show, especially after this, they're going to try to make it look like he's so popular that people were happy to vote for him.
It's very.
Yeah, it would be like 85.5%. Let's bet on that.
maybe 80 something, 83.
Okay, so earlier you were kind of putting finger on a really interesting spot there, Mira. I'm going back to what I said earlier. Something like this has happened in elsewhere. I mean, there would have been court cases to follow, huge discussion to follow. People who call themselves opposition, they would jump into this discussion, and nothing like this is happening. So this is just kind of exposing, if nothing else, if the whole idea of reform in Uzbekistan, its reach, and all these things. That's very interesting. So I think we need to be wrapping up the discussion very soon. So what should be our takeaway from all this? Bruce and Mira, let me take your points on this, and then I have a last point for Carl. Bruce, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I mean, it does kind of shatter the image that Mirziyoyev has been trying to project of himself as like this man of the people that's really out to root out corruption and get Uzbekistan working under a different system than it was before, a more positive system than it was. You know, I think, like I said, as far as what his popularity among the people, yeah, I mean, it'll hurt, but it won't. They'll do whatever they can to cover that up. But Uzbekistan is trying to build itself as a great place for investment, you know, that they're going in a new direction. And I think that's probably where you probably see where it hurts him a little bit is, you know, are people, what about foreign direct investment, joint projects, things like that? Because these people, foreign investors, are going to look and see this and go, you know, where exactly did all that money come from? Especially when they've been getting aid to fight the spread of coronavirus, as well as other investments in Uzbekistan, you know, because it's open for business, as they're always happy to say. And if you're an investor right now and you look at this palace and you're thinking about sinking a couple $1 billion in it, you got to wonder what percentage of the money I'm about to spend is actually going to end up going where it's supposed to.
Yeah, and also the fact that nothing else is happening in response to this investigation, like any no court cases, nothing like that. So, Mira, your takeaway briefly, please, so we need to conclude the discussion.
Yes, yeah, I mean, as per the court cases, of course, yeah, if it was in the U.S., it would be a huge disaster, and they would be considering it in court. But as there is no independent judiciary in Uzbekistan, so that's not going to happen. I do support Bruce's idea on foreign direct investment, but at the same time, I think that, you know, there is a huge lobbying going on there abroad. I think even if they see this report and they say, okay, so maybe they believe in those guys, probably most likely that they believe in the guys and in their official rhetoric that Uzbekistan is a great place, and then they're going to continue come, you know, investing. Well, that's my prognosis. And what international community can do is that I think this is a time now to act, not just to talk. And they can do, you know, a number of things like blocking assets, you know, the officials and the bureaucrats who were involved in grand corruption, and ban visas to certain people, maybe economic sanctions. Maybe it's time now to consider those things rather than just keeping silent.
You're saying that honeymoon should be over now. Final word from you, Carl. You know, you have been busy with major similar investigations over the past couple of months, earlier ones being the Kyrgyz report, and then as well as the Nazarbayev family properties abroad. Is there any comparison to be drawn between these reports? If so, what stands out to you?
I guess, you know, broadly, what stands out is that you have ruling elites that generally seem to have a sense that there's not going to be any accountability for how taxpayer money is used, or for corrupt dealings, that basically this everything can be swept under the rug. I would say that's kind of each of these investigations, you know, had their own different nuances. But if I were to look at one broad theme, you know, that would be something that I see that unites them. And this is, of course, not unique necessarily to Central Asia or even the former Soviet Union. I mean, this happens with ruling elites all over the world. But it is something that we do see in Central Asia, and definitely something that's problematic and is difficult for civil society to deal with without things like independent judiciaries or competitive elections.
Right. Thank you very much, Carl, for your great work. And also big thanks goes to our Uzbek service team. It's been possible because of their hard work. So now what we discussed today, I guess it is just barely, we scratched the surface, I guess. So I would strongly recommend for our audience to go to Ready for Your Freedom Liberty's website to read the report by yourself. There are a lot to be read. There are a lot to be, you know, discovered. With this, I guess we should wrap up the conversation right here. Thank you very much again, Carl Schreck, Ready for Your Freedom Liberties Enterprise editor, Delmira Matyakumova, researcher, co-director at UZ Investigations, Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Your Freedom Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Colleagues, thank you again for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Your Freedom Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.